Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute's Friday Lecture Series online edition. My name is Anthony Wong, Program Coordinator for the Institute. I'd like to welcome all of you for joining us at home. And I want to thank you very much for joining us to kick off our first lecture of the spring semester and to celebrate Women's History Month. And we're honored to have Professor Julie Sook from the CUNY Graduate Center with us today to speak about her recently published book, We the Women, the Unstoppable Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment, which explores the ERA's past to guide its future and tells the stories of the forgotten women lawmakers and lawyers that who shaped the ERA over a century. Professor Sook is the Professor of Sociology, Political Science, and Liberal Studies at the CUNY Graduate Center. She was recently a Florence Rogetz Visiting Professor of Law at Yale Law School. And prior to joining the Graduate Center, Professor Sook was a law professor at Cardozo Law School and a visiting professor at the law schools of Harvard, Columbia, the University of Chicago, and UCLA. Professor Sook is an interdisciplinary legal scholar focusing on women as constitution makers at the intersection of law, history, sociology, and politics. Her broader research interests include constitutional and social change, anti-discrimination law and its effects on social inequality, women work and family, civil litigation as an enforcement mechanism for public law, access to justice, including the past and future role of non-lawyers in solving the civil justice problems of the poor and middle-income people, social, political, and legal theory, and law and literature. In addition to her 2020 book, We the Women, Professor Sook is currently working on her second book entitled Misogyny's Law, How the Law Fails Women and What to Do About It, due sometime in 2022. And so without further ado, please welcome Professor Julie Sook.
So much, Anthony, and thanks so much to Ari for hosting this lecture. I'm thrilled to be with all of you today. So I will be talking about my book, We the Women, the Unstoppable Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment, which explores the history of women as constitution makers in the United States. As many of you probably know, this past fall, we lost one of the great icons, I would like to say one of the great founding mothers of the U.S. Constitution, the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Although she was a judge and a justice of the Supreme Court for much of her life, really the last 40 years of her life, her legacy is the changes that she made in the 1970s as a lawyer and a legal scholar with regard to the inclusion of women and women's rights in the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution that she transformed remains alive, even though she is no longer with us. Because as a lawyer, a judge, and a justice, and ultimately as a cultural icon known as RBG, she updated the Constitution to make it possible for 21st century Americans to continue to live under a document that was made over 200 years ago when everything was different and when women weren't even considered full legal persons. She implemented a lot of constitutional changes by standing on the shoulders of women who designed those changes generations before her. She inspired many women who have continued to build on her work today. And the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have been a formal amendment to the US Constitution, which she theorized and defended in her academic work and in her advocacy before she became a judge, is a topic that has come back into the public conversation in recent years. We can also begin by thinking about some of the women who made the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s. Shirley Chisholm, her exhortation in the early 1970s in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment in Congress included the words, "The time is clearly now to put this House on record for the fullest expression of that equality of opportunity which our founding fathers professed. There were no Black founding fathers. There were no founding mothers, a great pity on both counts. It is not too late to complete the work that they left undone." It really is not too late. Today in 2021, a need to complete a more inclusive constitution than the one that our founding fathers adopted in 1787 is more urgent than ever before. The story of the amendment that RBG and Shirley Chisholm and many women who came before them believed to belong in the Constitution, the Equal Rights Amendment, reveals, as a matter of fact, that our Constitution actually has many founding mothers, equal in brilliance and the contributions they made to constitutional democracy in this nation to the founding fathers that we are so familiar with. So my book, We the Women, tries to unearth the stories of these generation of women. And I call them unstoppable mothers. Our founding mothers are unstoppable, largely because even though it remains to be seen whether the Equal Rights Amendment will actually be added to the Constitution, so many of the arguments that they made for why sex equality was important and belonged in the Constitution have become part of our law in other ways. The idea of sex equality is an idea that the Supreme Court has enforced in jurisprudence around the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. So whether or not the ERA formally gets added to the Constitution, the ideas behind the ERA are already part of the constitutional law that is practiced and enforced throughout the country. Nonetheless, the goal of the ERA that many of these women fought for was to recognize women as fully equal citizens with rights equal to men. And this is a goal that was not invented in the 1970s when the ERA was adopted by Congress or in recent years when the ERA completed ratification. The goal of recognizing women as fully equal citizens was perhaps born in 1848, possibly sooner. The Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls, which was led by Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, involved the production of a document called the Declaration of Sentiments. And in that document, it was insisted that all men and women were created equal, and women in the women's rights movement that was born at that moment demanded the right to vote. And even though they demanded the right to vote in 1848 in the Declaration of Sentiments, the right to vote as a constitutional amendment did not get ratified in the United States until 1920. And in fact, it wasn't even introduced in Congress. That is, even though we had the Declaration of Sentiments at Seneca Falls in 1848, that amendment wasn't even introduced in Congress until 1878. And then finally, it was adopted by 2/3 majority of both houses of Congress in 1919 and then ratified by 3/4 of the states, at the time 36 states, in 1920. It took a very, very long time. And it takes a long time because our Constitution requires such a huge supermajority consensuses to make a constitutional amendment. 2/3 of both houses of Congress. Just imagine 2/3 of both houses of Congress agreeing to anything today in these days of polarization. So that's a huge consensus, then followed by 3/4 of the state legislatures. And under conditions, particularly when we think about women's suffrage, under conditions when women didn't even have the right to vote, that meant that they had to persuade men and only men who had the right to vote to give them the right to vote in order to make a formal constitutional amendment under Article 5 of the Constitution. But when the 19th Amendment was finally ratified in 1920, the women who had fought for suffrage thought it was only the beginning. They did not think that the vote was going to be enough to make women and men fully equal under the law. And even after women got the vote, there were many laws throughout the United States, both at the federal and state level, that discriminated against women and excluded them from certain rights, including property rights for married women, right to equal parental authority over one's own children, if one was a mother, as compared to fathers. So the idea behind the Equal Rights Amendment when it was first introduced in Congress in 1923 was to have a constitutional amendment that made women and men equal in all rights. And they tried to get that introduced in the 1920s, but it did not actually get adopted by Congress until the early 1970s. And the reason for this, well, there are many reasons for this. Largely, it was that for the most part, society was not totally on board with the notion that women and men should be equal in all domains. But also, there was this problem that within the women's movement itself, in the 1920s, there were concerns that having an equal rights amendment would mean that the law could never distinguish between men and women. And if they could never distinguish between men and women, then it might lead to a situation where efforts to protect women or to promote real equality by sometimes distinguishing between women and men, particularly women workers in industry or working mothers, that those efforts would be struck down by the Equal Rights Amendment, especially when there was a judiciary, a Supreme Court, that was very hostile to labor rights or workers' rights of any sort. So the politics from the 1920s through the early 1970s made it difficult for the amendment to garner the consensus required to make a constitutional amendment under Article 5. But another thing happened in the 1970s after Congress finally adopted the Equal Rights Amendment, which was that there was litigation that now Justice or the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg adopted, litigation that she led, that led the Supreme Court to enforce sex equality as a constitutional principle. It's important to note, though, that in the 1970s, when the ERA finally succeeded in getting two-thirds vote in Congress, both Martha Griffiths and who was the leading sponsor in the House of Representatives, that she worked with women like Shirley Chisholm, as well as Patsy Mink, the first Asian American woman, and in fact, the first non-white woman ever elected to Congress in 1964. And so they worked together to get the ERA off the ground. And when they did, it's really important to note the kinds of things they were interested in and why they wanted the amendment. Part of the problem was that there were a lot of laws that were on the books that actually discriminated between women and men. Laws that made it difficult, for example, for women to get credit cards, for married women to get credit cards without their husband's consent. Public institutions, including the Virginia Military Institute, for instance, that excluded women in their admissions policies. But these were not the only problems that they were interested in. Many of the lawmakers, including Patsy Mink and Shirley Chisholm, were also very interested in the sources of social disadvantage for women that they faced because they were mothers. And so many of the legislative projects that they were interested in working on at the same time that they were pursuing the ERA included childcare legislation, the Comprehensive Child Development Act, which garnered bipartisan support and was passed by Congress only to be vetoed by President Nixon in 1971. Patsy Mink is also known as the mother of Title IX. This is landmark legislation that was passed in the same year that both houses of Congress passed the ERA. Title IX is a distinctive statute because it doesn't only prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex. It actually requires gender parity in resources for federally funded educational programs. And so Patsy Mink and many of the women who were in the House, including Republican women, there were bipartisan efforts on all of these ideas. They really believed that what the ERA would really accomplish was, in addition to outlawing sex discrimination in the law, it would also create the political momentum to legitimize many other efforts to pass laws that would actually help women gain real equality on the ground. And that's a very important idea because there was so much support. There were only 9 women in the House of Representatives at the time. And they, most of them, actually all but one, supported the Equal Rights Amendment when it was passed in 1971, and then the one woman who was in the Senate at the time also supported the Equal Rights Amendment in 1972. So even though the Equal Rights Amendment was then passed by a huge, overwhelming majority of both houses of Congress in the mid-1970s, the ratifications by the states many of the states, a vast majority of the states, ratified the ERA very quickly, but reached a point where the ratifications began to stall in the late 1970s. The ratifications began to stall in the late 1970s, largely because, led by Phyllis Schlafly of the Stop ERA movement, there were fights in some of the states, particularly in the South, about whether or not the Equal Rights Amendment would destroy the American family. This was largely based on a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about what the ERA would actually do. Certainly, the opponents and Phyllis Schlafly's Stop ERA movement claimed that the ERA would lead to women being drafted. It would lead to the law never distinguishing between men and women, and never distinguishing in ways that would actually hurt women and make it impossible to help mothers and wives who might be disadvantaged by their role, by their traditional roles. Unfortunately, a lot of this misinformation led to a stalling of the process of ratification. And by 1977, only 35 states had ratified. 35 is actually the vast majority of the states. I mean, we have 50 states in the union, but Article 5 of the Constitution requires 3/4 of the states to ratify in order to make an amendment. And so when you have 50 states, you need 38 ratifications. So by 1977, there were only 35 ratifications that were completed. And the Equal Rights Amendment that had been adopted by Congress in 1972 had actually put a 7-year deadline on ratification by the states. And so because of that deadline, there was some concern in 1978 that the 3 additional states would not come in time for the deadline. So the Women's Caucus, formed by Liz Holtzman, who was at that time the youngest woman ever elected to Congress from Brooklyn, she led the Women's Caucus, a huge bipartisan effort of women in both houses of Congress to extend the deadline on ERA ratification. So they passed legislation in 1978 extending the deadline, but even with the deadline extension to 1982, the 3 additional states did not come through to ratify. So the ERA was forgotten for decades. In 1982, it was presumed dead. And we talked about it when I went to law school. It was just something that was mentioned in a footnote as a failed constitutional amendment. It was really not thought of. And so much of the action around women's equality focused more on laws that were passed and enforced, like Title IX, or Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits sex discrimination in employment. And with regard to constitutional equality for women, so much of the action was in litigation under the Equal Protection Clause, claiming that any discrimination by the federal government or any of the states on the basis of sex was actually a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And in 1996, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was finally a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, the second woman to become a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, the Supreme Court decided a landmark case called United States versus Virginia, where it struck down the discriminatory admissions policy of the Virginia Military Institute, which for, you know, over 100 years had excluded women from admission. The Supreme Court held in United States versus Virginia, which was decided 25 years ago in 1996, that the policy of excluding women was unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And Justice Ginsburg was the author of that judicial opinion. After she wrote that opinion, saying that sex discrimination was a constitutional violation, many people believed that we didn't need the ERA anymore because the ERA did, or sorry, the United States versus Virginia and the Equal Protection Clause did everything that the ERA was intended to do. And as a result, many people believed that there was no reason to continue fighting for the ERA. At the same time, many of the early concerns by the 1970s women in Congress, like Patsy Mink and Shirley Chisholm, were not really fulfilled by United States versus Virginia. A lot of the litigation under the Equal Protection Clause led to striking down laws that excluded women, but striking down laws by courts, that doesn't always mean that you're going to have robust public policies that are concerned with real equality for women on the ground. It doesn't necessarily mean that Congress can enact such laws and have them upheld by the Supreme Court. So one thing that happens in the year 2000 is that Congress passes a very comprehensive Violence Against Women Act. And an important feature of the Violence Against Women Act, which allowed women to sue perpetrators of gender-motivated violence in federal courts, the Supreme Court strikes that down, saying that Congress doesn't have constitutional power to do that. So that's one example of something that an ERA, if we had it today, would potentially correct. But most importantly, it would create the political vortex by which legislators on both the federal and state level could really address the true causes of inequality that women face today, and particularly after the economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. There are reports every day of how we're in the first ever female recession. Women's employment status and employment prospects, a lot of the progress that has been made on that front. I've read today that we're going to be back to 1988 in terms of losing much of the progress that we've made on women's equality, women's economic equality in the workplace. So in order to address those kinds of things, we need Congress and state legislatures really focusing on the real sources of inequality. And the Equal Rights Amendment can help provide that focus. It's not something that's going to strike down the lack of policy, but it's certainly going to give a political nudge and a source of legitimacy if there's ever a challenge to new public policies that robustly address the sources of women's advantage, and particularly advantages, disadvantages that women face because they are mothers, because of their traditional role in childbearing and child rearing. So with that in mind, it's important to understand what happens with the Equal Rights Amendment. Shortly after the Women's March in 2017, the Nevada state legislature revived the Equal Rights Amendment by deciding to ratify it, even though it was more than three decades after the 1982 deadline. The 1982 deadline was the extended deadline, but Nevada said, we're going to ratify this anyway and hope for the best. And then with the Me Too movement in full steam, Illinois ratified the Equal Rights Amendment in 2018. And then Virginia ratified the Equal Rights Amendment in 2020. In all three of these states, the leading sponsors of the ERA ratification effort were African-American women. Pat Spearman in Nevada, Juliana Stratton, who's now Lieutenant Governor, but was in the legislature in Illinois, and in Virginia, Jennifer McClellan in the Virginia Senate, and Jennifer Carroll Foy in the Virginia House of Delegates. So these African-American women played a role in saying the ERA is an unfinished project. We haven't gotten all of the things that the original framers of the Equal Rights Amendment had hoped for. We've gotten some of them with the United States versus Virginia and other Supreme Court decisions, but not everything. And so now is the time. The ERA is still needed and relevant in the 21st century. And so they ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. And as a result, there are very difficult and unprecedented constitutional questions that are now coming up about whether or not the deadline on ratification should be enforced. Because obviously, if you have three states that are coming in decades and decades after the deadline, One theory is that the deadline should never have been imposed in the first place and therefore has no real legal effect. Another theory, which is an important one, is that Congress has the power to remove the deadline. And in fact, last year, shortly after Virginia ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, the House voted to remove the deadline. And unfortunately, the Senate did not follow. But now in the 117th Congress, there are resolutions in both the House and the Senate to remove the deadline. If the deadline is removed by Congress, then the ERA most likely can and will be added to the U.S. Constitution, although certainly there are opponents and states who have not ratified or who have since rescinded their ratifications who will continue to litigate to challenge the validity of the Equal Rights Amendment. So that's where we stand with the ERA now. I think I'm going to end my remarks there. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I think it's important to think about the ERA, not only because of what it will do for women in America, but also because it's important to think about the process of constitutional change and the fact that women have been fighting for their inclusion for such a long time. And we have a constitution that's one of the oldest constitutions in the world and the most difficult to change. We have not had a constitutional amendment in the United States since 1992. The amendment that we got in 1992 was actually written by James Madison, and that amendment took 203 years to ratify. The point here is that our constitution is very old. It reflects a lot of values and principles that have endured since 1787, but it also reflects certain judgments that have not endured. That is, in 1787, women were not considered persons. And in 1787, there was a real question as to whether slavery should remain prohibited or not remain prohibited, should ever be prohibited. So there are a lot of questions and realities in 1787. And our Constitution has been amended to reflect certain changes in the way we think and in our values and in our sense of who's included. But it has changed very slowly, and it has changed slowly largely because of the difficulty of amending that you find in Article 5. So if the ERA can be legitimized now, I think it will open up a new conversation about why it is that our Constitution is so hard to change, particularly in the direction of greater inclusion. And it's my hope that starting that conversation will encourage a lot of people, particularly young people and new generations of Americans, to really think about being a constitution maker themselves. Think about all the other things in the Constitution that aren't perfect and need to be made more perfect by the process of amendment. And in thinking that way, perhaps there will be real prospects for the changes that we need at the constitutional level in the future.
Could you go over sort of how you went about doing this research and how you got interested in the first place in order to publish this book?
So for many years, I was a legal scholar of constitutional equality, both in the United States as well as outside the United States. And I'd actually spent a lot of time publishing a lot of law review articles and scholarly work about gender equality amendments in France, Germany, Italy, in other countries that occurred in my adult life. And what I learned is that in a lot of constitutions, especially newer constitutions that were written after World War I and World War II, it was a very normal feature of those constitutions to include a provision about the equal rights of men and women. That was just considered like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, equal rights of women and men. That was a feature of most constitutions drafted in the 20th century. And then what was happening in the mid-90s and early 2000s was that women's movements demanded even more amendments, because one of the problems was that with those equality amendments, when they try to do things like pass laws requiring an equal number of men and women in the legislature or on political party lists for, as candidates for elected office, there were courts that said, oh, you can't do that because equal rights means that you can't distinguish between men and women or have quotas like that. So then they amended the Constitution again, saying the law shall promote real equality. The law shall promote equal access between men and women to positions of power, to clarify that equality meant that you could actually take real measures to promote real equality on the ground. So I was really fascinated by that. And that's what really got me thinking about, wow, if people in my adult life can think of themselves as initiators of constitutional change and actually get an amendment done, what is it about the United States that we've had, the Equal Rights Amendment has been kicking around for so long, and then the only thing we know about it is that it's this failed amendment and ultimately not part of the Constitution. So those were the things that really got me started on writing about the ERA as an interesting problem. But when I picked up, when I started writing about it in the scholarly literature, it was largely an academic subject. Nobody actually believed that the ERA could be revived. But I was interested academically in understanding the historical sources of its failure in light of a counter narrative of success in gender equality amendments in Europe and in many other countries around the world. But the curious thing that happened when I started, when I'd already published a few articles, is that after Donald Trump was elected and you had the Women's March, all that momentum made it actually possible for Nevada to step up and say, we don't care if it's 35 years late, we're going to ratify the ERA and see what happens, right? And then there was this cascade because of the Me Too movement and because of the centennial of the 19th Amendment coming up in Virginia, that you ended up having these three additional ratifications. And then that opened up all these interesting questions about the deadline and what kinds of things should we be thinking about when we decide as a political matter, if Congress is going to decide, should we remove the deadline or not? A lot of it depends on, well, how did the deadline get there in the first place? Why have women failed for so long to get an amendment about their equal rights? So that's what prompted me to write this book, which is really a history of the amendment. And I focused in writing the book primarily on the legislative history, the debates in Congress, the hearings in Congress, the floor debates in the three states that most recently ratified. Those were my primary materials to really find the voices of the women who explained why they were fighting for the ERA and what they'd hoped it would mean.
How long was the process of writing the book?
Well, it depends how you start. I mean, I've been, I would say for the last probably 15 years, thinking about anti-discrimination law and constitutional equality. And so to the extent that a lot of the research I was doing, even before it occurred to me to write the book, helped me write the book, you might say that the process was as long as maybe 15 or 20 years. But the actual book, when I decided to write it, you know, an agent heard me give a talk about something else, and she knew that the suffrage centennial was coming up and wanted to think about not just the suffrage centennial, like the 19th Amendment, the women's right to vote as a historical moment, but taking stock of it now and where are we with constitutional women's rights now? And the ERA. So I say when we decided, or when I decided that I was going to do, and this is a general audience book. I mean, there's a lot of material in it that a lot of law professors probably don't know because they haven't spent a lot of time thinking about the ERA or researching the ERA, but it's really intended for a general audience. You don't have to be a lawyer, a law professor, or a law student to be able to read, and I hope enjoy and appreciate what's in the book. But I started writing it probably like, I'd say sometime about 2 years ago. And then I think the process of writing it took maybe about 7 or 8 months.
Okay.
And then it went into production.
I see. In regards to the deadline for the ERA, you actually had an interesting story where a student actually did some research and found out, I mean, did more research into the 27th Amendment and then started sort of a campaign, I think, or sort of discussion regarding how the deadline could actually push back and didn't matter when the states actually ratified the ERA.
Yeah, so a curious thing happened. In 1982, the ERA was in the news quite a lot because when Congress extended the deadline, the new deadline was June 30th, 1982. And as that deadline was coming up, a lot of people started asking this question, well, if there was an amendment that had no deadline, could it still be ratified now? Because the thing with deadlines is that for the first 100 years of the U.S. Constitution, Congress never used deadlines. The first time that they used a deadline was with the Prohibition Amendment in 1919. But then after the Prohibition Amendment, almost every amendment that succeeded in the United States had a deadline, a seven-year deadline. The only exception to that is the 19th Amendment, actually. So in 1982, as the deadline was approaching, people were asking, well, if there are amendments that are floating around that never had a deadline from way back when, could they still be ratified now? And if they were, would they be valid? And there was an amendment. And in fact, there are a couple of amendments that were part of the original Bill of Rights. But even though the Bill of Rights got ratified by 3/4 of the states in 1789 or between 1789 and 1791, there were a couple that didn't get all the states to ratify. And one of them is what's now the 27th Amendment, known as the Madison Amendment. And it was a provision that said that if Congress voted to give itself a raise, it would not actually go into effect until the next election, just to prevent self-dealing by members of Congress, you know. So, but it didn't get ratified by the requisite number of states, and most people just kind of forgot about it. But I think because in 1982, there was all this attention to deadlines and what they meant, an enterprising student at the University of Texas, just a college student, decided to look up all the amendments that did not have deadlines and were not completed. Mm-hmm. And he identified this one and started, and he said, wow, that seems pretty unobjectionable, right? If Congress gives itself a raise, they have to wait for it to go into effect. That seems pretty unobjectionable. Why haven't we ratified this? So then he started writing to all these state legislators saying, why haven't we ratified this? Shouldn't this be ratified? And I think that was one triggering event. And of course, this was during a time when people were also very focused on just political corruption or, you know, the disengagement of legislatures and Congress from the people. So I think it was a time when people were like, oh, why don't we pass this amendment? So a lot of states started ratifying that what's now the 27th Amendment in the mid-1980s, and finally got up to 38 states by 1992, at which point Congress, both houses of Congress, just passed these resolutions recognizing that that amendment was ratified. And I think that was very eye-opening for constitutional law scholars and for the American people, because what it showed was that you could get an amendment to the Constitution, even though the original framers of the amendment were no longer with us, and the people who ratified the amendment in the 18th century and 19th century were no longer with us. The idea that you can make an amendment across generations and not just like synchronously within a few years. That was a new idea. And there were some Supreme Court cases that had suggested prior to this moment that you can't make an amendment except synchronously, that if it's not synchronous, it's not valid. So this called that into question. And once that was called into question, then the people who were committed to getting an equal rights amendment began to think, well, if we got three more ratifications and then Congress just changed the deadline, they changed the deadline once, why can't they change it again? They could even say they can change it by abolishing the deadline. Could that be a valid way of making a constitutional amendment? And that became known as three-state strategy. And it's the adherents of the three-state strategy that have promoted what's happened in recent years. There are certainly scholars of constitutional law and politicians who think that the three-state strategy is not legitimate. And that is a question that's being litigated in courts right now, because there are some state attorney generals who are saying that you can't do this. The ERA is dead. It's too late. The deadline has passed. So if you really want an ERA, you have to start from scratch and reintroduce it in Congress and collect 38 ratifications all over again.
I see. Now, you also discussed women who supported the ERA, but there's also women who did not support the ERA back in the 1970s when it was first adopted. Could you also discuss that a little bit? There was the Stop ERA group, who was headed by Phyllis Schlafly, I believe, and then sort of a figurehead during that particular time to stop the momentum. After sort of 30 plus states, I believe 30 states in the beginning, with Hawaii being the first adopting the ERA.
Mm-hmm. So there were always women who opposed the ERA, but for very different reasons. So I could start with the early 1920s. The women who opposed the ERA, led by Florence Kelly, were actually feminists who had supported women's suffrage. What they were concerned about in the 1920s was very specific. They were really worried that if they got an ERA, the justices of the Supreme Court, who were very conservative at the time, would use it as an excuse to strike down labor laws that actually helped working women, helped immigrant women by reducing their hours and protecting their minimum wages. There were laws on the books that only protected minimum wages for women at the time and not for women and men both, because the Supreme Court, again, a very labor hostile Supreme Court, had been striking down labor laws like minimum wage and maximum hour laws since 1905. And it wasn't until you got FDR appointing appointing Supreme Court justices in the 1930s that the Supreme Court changed from conservative to more labor friendly, more New Deal friendly. And so that problem went away and opposition to the ERA diminished as a result of that. Then you get conservative. So you'd say, I mean, in the early days, there was opposition to the ERA from the left, not from the right. Whereas in the 1970s, people like Phyllis Schlafly argued that if you got the ERA, it would almost force women to go to work. And it would force all these changes that would mean that women could no longer choose to be homemakers and full-time mothers. And what she was saying was not really true. I think she believed that if women had equal opportunities and took them, then it would actually change, cause a major social transformation. And she was right to some degree. I mean, one of the difficulties of equality and equal opportunity for women is that the framers of the ERA knew that if women were going to have equal opportunity in the workplace, that equal opportunity would not be particularly meaningful unless the government also did something about the home. Specifically, if women are going to work, who's going to take care of the kids? So equal opportunity in the workplace necessarily had to mean public investment in childcare and education. If you really wanted women to be equal on the ground, you had to not only open up the barriers, but create infrastructure. And unfortunately, I think that in the United States, we focused so much on opening up the barriers without focusing on building the infrastructure. And I think Phyllis Schlafly kind of distorted and capitalized on this problem by saying that if women went to work, then the family would just crumble and the American family, as we know it, would just disappear and cease to exist. And I think people were very scared then of what would happen.
You mentioned Patsy Mink, one prominent Asian American woman who helped out the ERA. There's also Dr. Mabel Lee, who was a suffragist back in the for the 19th Amendment. During your research, do you know whether or not she had any influence in regards to the ERA? Even though she passed away in 66, so she didn't see it get adopted, but did she have any influence at all at that particular time during the women's movement?
So I have not seen her name come up in the research that I've done on the ERA.
Oh, well, were there any other Asian Americans who were sort of involved in the particulars of the ERA other than Patsy Mink?
So I think that, Patsy Mink is the one, because she was in Congress at the time and was actually a very vocal supporter, that's the main figure that I see. I've not seen a lot of Asian American women in the legislative histories. It's primarily African American women.
Okay. During the push for the 19th Amendment and also the ERA, there was also an issue in regards to a split between the white suffragists and the black suffragists in terms of getting it passed. Could you discuss that a little bit? Sort of why was there a split?
So, I don't know that I would call it a split. I mean, the real issue was that if you think structurally about Article 5, you need 2/3 of Congress and 3/4 of the states. And 3/4 of the states means that the South has veto power over any constitutional amendment. And so a lot of the women in the suffrage movement, white women, they, as a practical matter, thought they were not going to win a constitutional amendment unless they could bring on the South. And the South, as it existed for really for a very long time, and voter suppression continues today, the South, even after the Civil War and Reconstruction, suppressed the political power of African Americans, even though they were technically enfranchised by the 15th Amendment. And so as a result, I think that many white suffragists tried to play racial politics to gain support for suffrage. And so one example is Alice Paul, who's one of the most famous and most militant suffragists of this period. She was responsible for organizing a very big attention-getting suffrage parade in 1913. And when she organized that big suffrage parade around Wilson's inauguration, she was very concerned about making sure that there were a lot of Southern women marching in that parade. And she knew that those Southern women would not want to march alongside African-American women as their equals. So Alice Paul asked the African-American women's groups to march at the back of the parade. And not all of the African-American women's groups were on board with that. So in the book, I spent a good amount of time talking about Mary Church Terrell, who started a black sorority at Howard University, and their group marched at the back of the parade. But Ida Wells, very famously, African-American journalist, just kind of went into the procession with her group of white suffragists from Illinois and integrated the parade by just jumping in right in the middle of the Illinois procession. So I think there were very different ideas about strategy on all sides. But I think it is important. I mean, certainly there were racist dynamics that helped get the 19th Amendment passed. And what that meant was that there are suffragists who did not do enough and in fact actively obstructed efforts to ensure that African-American women and other women of color would vote after the 19th Amendment. But at the same time, there are also important moments from the mid-19th century all the way to the time that the 19th Amendment is passed and through the present, where you see solidarity and efforts to work together across women of different races. And I think both stories are very important to understanding the success of movements like the 19th Amendment as well as the ERA.
Now, with the most recent election that happened and the Democrats in control of both houses of Congress, do you happen to see the ERA sort of getting three more additional states to ratify it within these next 2 years? Or have you heard of any particular states that have been discussing it positively and moving towards ratification?
So right now there are 38. So you need 38 and there are 38 because the three additional states that ratified in the last 3 years made 38. Okay. So the real issue now is this. So another thing that happened, which I just briefly mentioned, is that in the mid-1970s, there are five states who ratified the ERA and then they changed their minds. Mm. So then they took these votes saying, we're withdrawing, we're rescinding our ratification. And a very interesting constitutional question is, can they do that? Can you just change your mind and take back a ratification, right? If they can, if you say they're allowed to change their minds, then suddenly we're back at 33 ratifications, not 38, because we're going to minus the five rescinders, right? Now, if that happens, but let's say that Congress or the courts decide that it's okay to extend the deadline or to remove the deadline, then you might need five additional ratifications whenever. And there are actually movements. So there are efforts in Arizona, in Utah, in Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Louisiana. There are efforts in all of those states to and Missouri. So there are legislators who are introducing resolutions, Georgia as well, but it's not really clear whether the politics will line up to get those resolutions passed. But then again, it surprised a lot of people that in Nevada, Illinois, and Virginia, they had been introducing these ERA ratification resolutions for a few years, and then the momentum picked up at those moments. So I would say there's a chance. It's hard to predict how big that chance what we think the chances really are. But certainly there are more than five states right now who have not ratified the ERA, where legislators are making noise about getting that done in those states. So even with the five rescissions, it's possible that in the next several years, you'll get five additional ratifications.
And then in regards to your current project, you're working with a group of individuals in regards to the ERA right now, academically. Columbia, I believe you mentioned.
So, well, there's a new project that's part of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School. And they've created a new project, which they hope will be a think tank and a center for strategizing around the ERA and collecting academic research that could be helpful for answering some of the very difficult and unprecedented legal and constitutional and political questions that are coming up because of the revival of the ERA. So that's the ERA project at Columbia Law School. So I and several colleagues who are professors throughout the country at many different institutions have been invited to join the academic advisory board of that project. And so because it's just getting started, it's not that clear right now exactly what it will do. But what we are trying to do anyway is to get more professors and students talking with activists and politicians about what the ERA is, why it matters, and what it might accomplish if it is kept alive.
I want to know, do you know of any active organization pushing for the ERA in the other state that's not being ratified yet?
Yeah, there are several organizations. So a lot of them are coordinated by a group called the ERA Coalition. And within the states, there's a group, they all have names like ERA Ratify, Project 28 in Missouri. So there are a lot of organizations. There's also a network called Generation Ratify. And these are mostly high school and college students who are devoted to getting the ERA ratified. And they have chapters in many states now, trying to mobilize young people around it. I know that in Arizona, the American Constitution Society, the Arizona chapter, has been very interested, and they've been doing a lot of panels and events and trying to engage state legislators in getting the ERA ratified there. And then there are also organizations who have not made the ERA their primary project, but they're engaged and supportive. So the National Women's Law Center, the ACLU, and they've put out some materials, the American Constitution Society as well. So there are a lot of organizations that are engaging in different ways with different focal points. But I would say the one that's primarily focused on getting the ERA added to the Constitution is the ERA Coalition.
I'd like to thank Professor Sook very much for kicking off our Friday Evening Lecture Series for the spring semester and to celebrate Women's History Month with us. I guess we'll look forward to other states ratifying the ERA, hopefully, within these next 2 years while the Democrats are in control of the houses. And we look forward to actually your next book in 2022 coming out soon, very, very soon. And with that, thank you very much for joining us. And we hope you have a great spring semester.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.